Good evening, everybody. Brian Alvarez here with a brand new edition of After Dark Radio here at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We have an awesome show for you here today. We're going to be joined in a couple of moments by Jeffrey Gray. He is the author of Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper. It is available right now in bookstores everywhere, hardcover. It's available on the Kindle as well. Talking one of the great mysteries that, in fact, in just a couple of months, we are going to be passing the 40th anniversary of the D.B. Cooper skyjacking. We're going to talk about that today. It's going to be an awesome show. Got the book right here in front of me. There's a lot of great stuff to talk about, so that's coming up in just a moment. Of course, check out the website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Head up there right now, and you can click over on the left-hand side of the page, and we've got an area called Past Shows. If this is the first show you've ever listened to, head over there, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Click on Past Shows. Scroll down. There's a million of them. Last week, we interviewed Leslie Kane, New York Times best-selling author, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Tons of shows available up there as well. A lot of great stuff. Check it out. And if you like the show, spread the word. We're also up on Facebook, facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. Head up there, like the page. And of course, every Friday here at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, we have a brand new show. We're going to be back in just a moment, however. Carl Stern is back. We're going to talk all of the latest news, which is available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We'll talk all of that. And then later on in this program, Jeffrey Gray, author of Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper. He's going to be on the show. It's going to be a great time. Talk to you all in just a moment. Brian Alvarez here, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We are joined, as we are nearly every week, by Carl Stern, CarlStern.com. Lots of stuff to talk about today. Carl, what's going on?
Not a lot, Brian. I've been kind of researching D.B. Cooper because I understand you've got a special guest today who's going to be talking about that. You know, it's been in the news a lot lately with the FBI looking back into that case, and I can't wait for this show. This is the D.B. Cooper, the whole episode of everything that happened with that whole deal is just fascinating. One of the great unsolved crimes in American history, and I cannot wait for this show.
You know, what's amazing about D.B. Cooper is, you know, sometimes something happens and they go, oh, we got about 1,000 suspects, but, you know, there's just a couple of them we take seriously here. There have been around 1,000 serious suspects in the D.B. Cooper case. That's amazing. Not like 1,000. I mean, you work in law enforcement, you know. This is 1,000 suspects that the FBI actually took seriously in this case. Not just 1,000 weirdos and crazy people. I mean, God knows how many of those there were. But 1,000 that at least at one point they took seriously.
I know, and the thing is, there have been, you know, some of the suspects have been more compelling than others, but, and I'm not up on the latest of the FBI investigation, but I thought the last thing I saw was that the FBI was looking at somebody who maybe their name hadn't been out there as much as some of the other suspects.
Yeah, there was we'll talk to Jeffrey Gray, author of Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper, later on in the show about that case. It actually is interesting because his book was published in August, and this story that actually went out nationally, it was like a big story on the Drudge Report about how it's believed the case has been solved. There's this very promising new suspect. So we're going to talk to him about that because, of course, that came out like the same week that his book came out, and that suspect obviously is not in his book. So that's going to be pretty interesting. But Carl, actually we're just about the same age. So, you know, we weren't even around when the D.B. Cooper skyjacking took place, and we're almost, I mean, in a couple of months, Thanksgiving weekend, it's going to be the 40th anniversary.
Yeah, that's again, it's one of those just, you know, there are some crimes that have gotten to the American popular culture, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and things like that, but this is just one of those unsolved things. You know, some of the money turned up, I believe, in 1980, and was greatly deteriorated. It was found in a wooded area, and they confirmed that it was part of the money from the hijacking. I believe it was a satchel of $20 bills that was found. And, you know, from time to time, you'll hear things about, you know, a piece of a parachute was found, or maybe some clothing and things like that. But this just fascinating fascinating story. How elaborate a crime this was. I mean, for Pete's sake, a guy hijacked an American airliner over American soil and jumped out of it with a flipping parachute, and you know that's unsolved. I mean, it's just really, especially coming from a law enforcement background like I do, it's just one of those fascinating things, because a lot of crimes do, unfortunately, go unsolved, especially if they're random or something like that. Where I know one of the major suspects was an employee at one point in time for the airlines, and so a lot of times crimes get wrapped up like that because there are links or connections. There's a real myth in America that we have all this random violence and random crimes and just random murders, when in fact that's not true at all. There's a very small percentage of crimes, especially violent crimes and things like that, that there isn't a link, a connection. The victim knows the perpetrator and things like that. That's why cases generally get wrapped up so quickly. It's the random stuff that's so hard to wrap up, unless you just have, you know, a good lead or something, or the guy talks, or his buddy rats on him, or something like that. And so when you have something this ridiculous as a guy hijacking a major airline and jumping out of it with a parachute with a bunch of money, I mean, somebody's going to talk about that, you would think. And people have talked about it, but it seems like it's just one of those things that never has got all the loose ends tied up. You know, who was D.B. Cooper? And I'm just fascinated by this case, and I can't wait to hear this interview today.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that a lot of crimes are committed by someone you know. You know, if whatever the case might be, a sexual assault, maybe a robbery, that sort of thing, it's somebody that you know. And it's interesting because, like, what would you say the statistics are, like 80%? I mean, I've been told it's, like, very high.
Oh, I would say it's more than that, especially with sexual related assaults. It's actually far higher than that. It's actually in the 90 percentile range for that. As far as like violent crimes and stuff, where say home invasions or something like that, even those are way up into the high 70 percentile range. As far as, like, you know, you hear about these random home invasions and stuff, and it turns out they usually aren't. It's usually somebody, a family member who perhaps has substance abuse problems, trying to gain some money because they know where it's at, or steal some prescription medication or things like that, or they have a friend who's a friend of somebody that lives there. But there's usually a connection. It's very rare you just have a random act of violence. It does happen. Absolutely, it does happen. You know, people get robbed in, you know, parking lots and stuff. Occasionally it happens, but usually there is some sort of connection. And the ones where it isn't, those are very difficult, because your first thing you ask on any kind of crime is, did you know the person? Is somebody mad at you? Is this part of a divorce, a nasty divorce or something? Is there a child custody issue? Especially when you have, like, kidnappings and things like that. That's why, you know, you hear the old saying, the husband or the wife is usually the first suspect. Well, yeah, because the percentage of them being the perpetrator is extraordinarily high, and so you do want to rule those people out to begin with and build from there. And more often, you know, if the percentage of homicides is over 90% of a known relation, well, yes, you know, obviously there's 90% of the time they're going to fall in that net pretty quickly. When you start looking at the spouse or the child or the next door neighbor, and you just go out from there. And so when you have something like the D.B. Cooper hijacking and extortion, robbery, whatever you want to label it, that's, I mean, and again, you hear the old acronym, keep it simple, stupid, because the more complex your plan is, the more it can fall apart. And this is one of the most complex plans. I mean, this guy didn't just walk into a convenience store with a stocking over his head. He hijacked an airplane, a passenger airplane. He even switched planes. He gets money with a note. He gets a parachute. He jumps out into the wilderness of the Pacific Northwest. And there's so many places this plan could have fell apart. And yet, we still don't 100% know whodunit.
Now, it's also interesting because there are killers that, I guess due to a lack of empathy or whatever the case might be, I mean, they are more likely to target someone they don't know because, you know, they see killing a human the same way that some people see crushing a crane fly. You know, they don't see it as they don't see this person as a human being. So sometimes the best thing that can happen to you is to get to know this person, because then apparently they can sometimes have a hard time, you know, seeing you as a victim because they know you and they can, and you know what I'm talking about here? It's like, it's kind of, once they see you as a human being, they can't kill you, but a random person that they don't know, it's just a, you know, this person here walking down the road, they can kill that person.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, again, you know, where is the psychological thrill in just doing something so, you know, completely random? I mean, there's usually, you know, people, especially, and you know, I can't speak internationally because this is a cultural thing, but it seems like here in America, we, past generations and stuff, have this real black and white mentality as far as good and evil, bad and, you know, bad and good, and you got good guys and bad guys, when the truth is, there's vast shades of gray. You know, I've, in 17 years as a law enforcement officer, I've worked, you know, thousands of cases, and probably in none of them, maybe 0.001% of them, did the person think they were in the wrong. You know, even things like a robbery or something, they had a motive that to them made sense. You know, I'm having to, you know, I need this money because I have no money and I have no way of getting it, and I have to, you know, I have to have that money to buy these pills because I need these pills, and so they rationalize it in their minds. There's not this, generally speaking, and in a large portion of the time, there's not this, I'm just going to commit an evil act on a random person. There's generally some sort of motive that to the perpetrator makes sense, even if it harms another person. You know, a guy's not going to knock over a convenience store generally just for the thrill. Now, it does happen, but generally speaking, it's to obtain money to get something because he feels like he's trapped in a situation he can't escape from, and he needs the money, he thinks, for some legitimate purpose. Even though he knows what he's doing wrong, he can rationalize it. So the idea that, you know, evil people just jump out of bushes and grab people, while it does happen, and certainly it's not, you know, I don't want to trivialize that has happened to people, especially, you know, pedophile predators and things like that. But it's not like, you know, it seems like a lot of times here in the United States we just live in fear of everything. You know, we're inundated by 24-hour news. We're inundated by the internet and by especially nowadays with smartphones, iPads, 24-hour news. You know, the talk radio. It's just constantly in our head all these bad, evil things that are happening everywhere and that we're aware of. It seems like we live in a constant state of fear when it's really not the way it is. Yes, these things do happen, absolutely, and I would never in a million years trivialize you know, someone who's been a victim of that. But largely speaking, more people by far than not are not going to be the victim of this sort of stuff.
One last thing here before we do another story I wanted to talk about. Jeffrey Gray, who wrote this book, obsessed with the case, you know, I think anybody investigating anything like this for a period of time is going to become obsessed. But has there ever been like one crime that maybe you've had to investigate that was unsolved and it just ate at you? Anything that really sticks out?
Oh, absolutely. There is. We have a double homicide here that occurred. Oh, I don't remember how long ago now it's been. It's been right at 8 or 9 years ago, 10 years maybe. That I was the second person there, actually a county deputy. It was in his jurisdiction. I actually went to back him up. That came in as a 911 hang-up call, and most places now, they can, you know, when the call comes into 911, even if you hang up the phone, an officer still comes out to investigate to see if, you know, there's been something. And in this circumstance, there was a double homicide. And when I arrived with the other officer, and we again live in a very rural area, so this isn't like you're going to see on cops on TV where 40 police stand up, you know, show up and do it. You know, it's the middle of the night, and it's he and I, and that's it. And so we go into this scene where two people have been shot and killed and in their own home. There ended up being, I think, a substantial theft from the residence and stuff. And now, at around the same time, a person come up missing in the same general area, same town. And it seems like there were similar suspects involved in both of those. And to this day, both of those cases remain unsolved. And while we have suspects, certainly, it's been very difficult. In fact, it's cases like this that really end careers. I mean, it gets out of all the people that worked on this particular case, I think only three of us are left in law enforcement. Ironically enough, myself and the other guy that was there first and then one of the investigators are the only ones left, because it wears on you. It tears on. There was a young girl in the house too, like a small, you know, very young child there, who fortunately was in a bed covered up. And we don't know, you know, if something worse might have happened to this child had the child not been seen. But it's one of those things like that you really get in your head and really mess with you. And I know most people, I'm sure, remember the case of the child that fell in the well. Mm-hmm. Many years ago. What was Jessica or something like
yeah.
that? But all those officers there have ended up out of law enforcement. Several had very bad post traumatic stress experiences with that. In fact, several of them, I think at least two, if not three, of those people involved in that ended up committing suicide. And so, yeah, it's cases like that that really do cause problems. Still, all these years later, you know, we wish we could wrap this up and give everybody some closure. You know, the families, the investigators, and everything. And it just seems to, you know, a lot of people think, well, why don't you just, you know, go out and arrest a suspect on what you've got? Well, with double jeopardy laws and stuff, you only get one shot at proving your case. So if you do, your case isn't strong enough, you lose it, then, you know, the that's it. And that's what really, you know, you sit around and you question a million times, do we have enough to put this person in? Do we have enough to get a conviction? Do we have enough? And the problem is, you never know the answer to that question until you get it there.
Wanted to make mention of one last thing before we go. If you go to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, there is a link to an article, The Dark Side of the Placebo Effect When Intense Belief Kills. And it's about sleep paralysis. And it's actually a fascinating article. But the thing that was most interesting to me was when writing about the sleep paralysis here, and they're talking about what an individual who is afflicted with that feels and believes is going on. You know, this idea that there's somebody or something in the room with you, and it's on you, and it's pushing weight down on your chest, and you can't move. It's just amazing, because my dad had this exact same thing happen to him when he was a kid. He lived in Idaho, and he lived in an old house, and I've actually been to the house a million times. And in the pantry, there was a staircase that led down, which is terrifying enough, but, you know, he used to sleep down there. And one night he woke up and he just said, there was something on my chest. I could not move. I could not get up. It was sitting on me, and it scared the hell out of me. And eventually I managed to shove it off, and I ran upstairs and I never went down there again. And he thought the place was haunted, and just a terrifying story. But this is sleep paralysis. It happens to people all over the world. You know, it says that it happens, I mean, to many people, at least once in their lifetime this will happen, and just absolutely scares the hell out of them. But I just read that, and I thought that was fascinating.
I watched a documentary, and I believe the documentary is available on Netflix now. And if the title sticks in my head, I think is Dreams, and that might not be the right documentary. But there was an experiment that was done involving, of all things, cats and this same phenomenon. And there is your body apparently produces some sort of something. Chemical that during the deepest stages of sleep paralyzes your body, and that's like your deepest dream when you're having your most vivid dreams and so forth. According to this research, your body is paralyzed, and so some researchers said, well, what happens if it's not? And so somehow or another they developed a chemical that counteracted this. And they gave it to cats and watched the cats and videotaped the cats as they were sleeping. And it's amazing. These cats got up and were walking around as though they were wide awake. They appeared to be hunting things. They appeared to be crouching and hiding and like toying with invisible objects and stuff as though they were hunting and so forth, when their bodies weren't paralyzed by this chemical but they were sound asleep, completely asleep, and apparently having vivid dreams. And researchers, of course, began to theorize that that dreams perhaps are our way of polishing up skills that we are natural to us. They're our way of putting of practicing, I guess, for lack of a better word, and that's why our bodies are paralyzed, and that occasionally, though rarely, you can become conscious during this stage, and your body yet is still paralyzed, and that's what perhaps produces this phenomenon, which kind of makes sense to me.
I haven't had the feeling of something on me, but hasn't happened in many years, actually. But I have had the experience where like I wake up and like my eyes are half open and but I can't really see. You know, I'm kind of like maybe my eyes are rolled up in my head, but my eyes are open. So but I cannot move. I cannot move. It doesn't feel like anything's pushing on me or there's anybody there. It's just like I just can't move. And it's infuriating, and you're trying to move, and you can, and you can't really see anything, but you know your eyes are kind of open, and it's like you're just stuck, and then finally, bam, you wake up, and it's just, God, I hated that, but it only happened a couple of times in my life, but it was just like, it was so disconcerting. It's just,
you know, dreams are one of the things that, I think there needs to be a lot more research on. It's something everybody does. It's something that we've apparently always done. Literature, all the way back, especially religious literature, takes and puts a lot of credence into dreams as far as, you know, spiritual or perhaps supernatural meanings for it. Yet it seems like it's one of the things that we don't study very much and we don't know a lot about. And, you know, because you would think as commonplace as dreams are, yet as much significance is placed on them historically, it would be something we'd really want to know, you know, what is going on here. And, it's one of my areas of interest is, you know, what is this all about? There was a study a long time ago, and I don't remember many of the details about it. I actually read about it in a book, and I've tried to do some online research about it since then, and I haven't come up with a lot. But there was one theory at once upon a time that perhaps some of your dreams are actually not dreams. They're actually memories encoded in your DNA from your ancestors. Some of the things that they actually really experienced, people you dream about that you've never seen, and yet you're talking to a person that you don't know this person, but perhaps your great-grandpa did. Perhaps that was your great-grandpa's brother or something, and that was a memory that somehow through your DNA has remained with you. And, things like that just fascinate me, that, you know, you see places and you see people you've never gone, people you've never seen, and maybe that's some remnant left over from an ancestor or something.
Well, Carl, let's get some plugs in here and talk about your websites and everything else you do.
All right. Well, I'm glad you asked because I have, of course, carlstern.com, Carl with letter K, K-A-R-L, carlstern.com. I just today reactivated my Facebook page. I had some problems with it previously, but now I'm back on Facebook, got it all updated. I am there as Carl Stern, so send me a friend request and I'll get you added. And I'm on Twitter as Dragon King Carl, and all that information, just go to carlstern.com. That'll give you all your appropriate links. And again, Facebook's back up and going, so communicate with me there and friend request me.
And, of course, we're on Facebook as well, facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow, as well as the website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com, where all of the news that we talk about on this show ends up. So check out both those places. We're going to be back in just a moment. Jeffrey Gray, author of Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper, going to be an awesome interview here on the After Dark Radio Show at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We are joined today by a very special guest. Jeffrey Gray is on the show. He's the author of Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper, available in bookstores everywhere, Amazon.com. I've got it here on the Kindle. It's a great book and particularly intriguing for myself as I live here in Bothell, Washington, which is very close to at least particularly one of the suspects we'll be talking about today, who in fact lived in Bonnie Lake. And Jeffrey Gray, how are you doing today?
Excellent.
Bonnie Lake. I was actually reading the book, and I was reading about one of the many suspects that you talk about here in the book, Kenneth Christensen, and you talked about him living in Bonnie Lake, and it was funny because about 2 weeks ago, I was in Bonnie Lake, and you drive up this big hill, and all of a sudden, there's Mount Rainier. It's like the biggest mountain you've ever seen right in front of your face. It's a beautiful place, and Kenneth Christensen lived there in Bonnie Lake, and I'm reading this book, and it's like, God, I've been to Bonnie Lake. I've obviously been to SeaTac a million times, so particularly intriguing book for myself. And I guess the Bothell, Seattle area, you've heard of Bothell, and I guess thoughts of this location?
Well, this is Cooper Country, for sure. You know, SeaTac was where the plane itself landed, where the money and parachutes were brought on board, and where the Cooper legend really was born, you know, in the Pacific Northwest.
Go ahead.
No, I think, you know, one of the most unique things about Bonnie Lake and was just what a normal place it was, and just a place where, you know, people could have passed Kenneth Christensen as he was in his overalls and suspenders, as his brother described him, out working in his yard. And the idea that this could have been the hijacker and people could have passed him on their way home every day for years is kind of a delightful, you know, idea to entertain. You know, that the hijacker himself could have been hidden in plain sight.
Now, let's talk about this. I think that most everybody listening to this right now knows the story of D.B. Cooper. I would really be stunned if anybody has not heard the name. But very quickly, a capsule profile of D.B. Cooper and the hijacking that occurred over Thanksgiving weekend in 1971. What exactly happened?
Well, you know, here we are, if you can imagine. Let's go back into time for a second. You know, let's go back. It's 1971. It's the day before Thanksgiving. And what you're seeing in the airport in Portland is lots of officers, lots of soldiers coming back from Vietnam. And this was just a really tumultuous time in American culture. You know, the music itself represented what was just a real generational war brewing, cultural war brewing, a society itself unhinged. You know, you have bombs going off in government buildings. You have campuses on fire. You have people just killing cops in the middle of the street, running their cars into cops, riots erupting in urban centers, in prisons, and just a feeling of helplessness, a feeling of chaos, of paranoia. You know, we have, at the time in the Portland International Airport, the day before Thanksgiving, 1971, lots of construction. And what was going on was that the Portland International Airport was becoming itself a giant hub, and they were expanding the airport like many airports were, to accommodate the 747, which is a plane we take for granted now, but really was an invention this giant flying machine that shrunk the world. It could transport so many people back and forth to places that they never thought they'd ever go to. And it really created, along with other advances in technology, a new mechanization of the way we live. And so we're in the airport, and we actually go out to board this flight, and it's a very short, small plane. Could fit about 96 people for a 28-minute flight to Seattle. One of the last passengers to board is a guy who's wearing horn-rimmed sunglasses, a suit jacket, a dark tie, and he's carrying an attaché case. The flight is boarded. The plane begins to take off down the runway, and just as liftoff happens, he passes along a note to a stewardess, and first of all, she doesn't look at the note, and then he says, "Miss, you know, you better take a look at that note." And she reaches into her purse, and she grabs his envelope, and she opens up and reads his note. Now, one of the first things she notices about the note is the formation of the letters in which he wrote. They were the work of an artist, really finely printed in black felt-tip pen. And when she read them, she thought he was joking. And the words were, "Miss, I have a bomb here. I would like you to sit by me." And she looked at him and she's like, "You know, are you sure? I mean, are you really kidding?" And he opened up his leather attaché case and he showed her cylinders that were red, that looked like dynamite, and a bunch of wires, and a full-on hijacking ensued.
Not good.
Well, it turned out good for him because he had planned it out so well that it has become the only hijacking that's ever gone unsolved. And he was able to get away with his demands, which were $200,000 and parachutes. And once the passengers were released in Seattle, the plane took off again high over the Pacific Northwest and in the middle of a storm late at night. He disappeared. You know, nobody knows where he jumped. And it's just endured as one of the greatest mysteries of our time. And within the mystery, many other mysteries, which is, makes the case so difficult to solve.
You know, one of the great things about the book is you know, you tell the story there very, very quickly. But in the book, I mean, it's many, many chapters just going over all the details of him getting on the plane, the note, you know, how everybody was reacting on the plane. And what I loved about the book is it's not just the story of D.B. Cooper, but I'm a big fan of just history books in general, and that's what this was. I mean, I learned so much in this book just about, you know, you hear about skyjacking. I mean, it's the name of the book, Skyjack. You think about hijacking and that sort of thing. And nowadays, I mean, if you're a young person growing up, I mean, when's the last time? I mean, obviously, you know, September 11th, but, you know, it's not like this is something that you hear about on a weekly basis. But, you know, at that period, you know, in the early 70s, you know, I mean, there were skyjackings happening all the time.
Once a week around the world.
Astonishing. And you mentioned in the book that a lot of these were skyjackings, you know, people attempting to get to Cuba. But, you know, when he opens his case and he's got this stuff in there and he hands her this note, I mean, nowadays, you know, some people might think, okay, well, you know, obviously this is a joke or that sort of thing or whatever. But, I mean, you know, when something like this is happening once a week, I mean, this was immediately a very serious issue here to be taken seriously.
Yeah, well, it was really tough because, you know, it was really tough to figure out how serious it was. And in the initial moments of the hijacking, the pilots really struggled to ascertain how serious the threat was, because it was as easy in 1971 to walk onto an airplane as it is to enter a supermarket. You know, there was really nothing preventing anybody from boarding an airplane, and there are just all kinds of crazy people in the world, and they would board with all kinds of things. I mean, knives, guns, some real, some fake, starter pistols, you know, all different kinds of, I don't want to say sociopaths, but troubled people with bad chemicals floating around their minds and trying to, you know, in a lot of ways, achieve both their own kinds of celebrity, which was also the 15 minutes of fame was sort of born around that moment, and also many looking for a way to commit suicide. You know, it's, you know, when you talk to or read the reports of psychologists about what drives bank robbers and what drives actually hijackers, especially during this period, it wasn't always political and it wasn't always for the money. These were troubled people who, after years of failure and depression, were looking to achieve one fine thing. And often for them, that did mean suicide. And I think that that's, you know, part of the undercurrent to this. And one of the things that I found in reporting this book and writing it, which took almost 4 years cover to cover, was that there's a huge difference between the D.B. Cooper myth and the hero we've all made him out to be and the Dan Cooper story, which is the real hijacker's alleged alias. And they're two completely different tales. One is about a courageous sky pirate. The other one, in my opinion, is about a lonely, potentially suicidal, downtrodden loser of a guy.
When you talk about, you know, you could get on the plane with anything, have you seen the film version of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas?
You know, I have. It's been some time, but I have.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the movie, I mean, you know, Johnny Depp's character drops off, you know, his buddy right there on the tarmac. And, you know, he runs from the car across the tarmac, gets on the plane. And this was right around the same period, you know, 1971. And, you know, you read the book and, you know, nowadays it's just preposterous to think of this sort of thing. But this is exactly how it was. I mean, this guy had his attaché case with sticks of dynamite supposedly inside and the battery and the whole nine yards, you know, not search or anything like that. He just walked in and the bomb's right there in his hand. He buys his ticket for $20 and gets on the plane. Boom. That's it. And it's just, I mean, tell everybody a little bit about why, I mean, you write about it a little bit in the book, but explain to everybody why security at that point had not even begun to get to the level that it was, you know, even prior to 9/11. But, you know, talk about, I guess, the issues involved with paying for the metal detectors and everything like that eventually came into play.
Well, at the time, right, you know, the day before Thanksgiving 1971, before this jump, because a lot happened after it, but before this jump, airplane security was in a state of real uncertainty. Now, originally, the people who had controlled airline security was not the nascent FAA or the federal government, but the airlines themselves. And the airlines had a predominant say over their pilots and over airports themselves and what was acceptable. And at the time, pilots were striking over these issues. The economy itself was terrible. And airplanes didn't want to pay for metal detectors because they thought it would inconvenience their passengers, who are wealthy executives mostly, at the time. And they just didn't want to go bankrupt. A lot of airlines actually went out of business during this period, so they were very hesitant to spend the cost of metal detectors. Furthermore, hijackings, even though there are many of them, didn't really cost the airlines anything because, you know, one crazy guy wants to go to Cuba. Well, that's only gas to Cuba. You know, they weren't really being extorted until the D.B. Cooper case, and the fatalities and the other kinds of forms of terrorism that had happened were, you know, it's tough to say, but kind of covered by insurance. So there wasn't really any motivation for them, the airlines and the airline presidents, to spend a lot of money on trying to make things safer. And the federal government under President Nixon was taking a very tacit volunteer approach. I mean, Nixon, he buckled. I mean, Nixon was actually friends with a lot of airline presidents and got a lot of contributions from them. And he did not want to put any business in the position of them having to spend unnecessary expense. And what he did instead was start the Sky Marshals, which is sort of a form of aerial law enforcement branch that randomly boarded planes looking to deter hijackings as they happened. And they also came up with a sort of psychological assessment and taught airline personnel how to prevent hijackings. But it worked, you know, a good number of the time. Actually, with the psychological assessment, airlines before 71, they claimed to eliminate 84% of airplane hijackings before they happened, right? That's not bad, 84%. But hey, that's still 16% of people actually getting on planes and with dangerous weapons or with fake weapons. And what's interesting about the Cooper case is that when the witness, and one of the things that I found when I got access to the FBI files, which is what a lot of the hijacking scene and a lot of the story is made from, and that hasn't happened before, is the stewardess reported the cylinders that she saw in his leather attaché cases being the color red. And on the ground, when they were listening to the hijacking unfold on the radio, FBI agents were like, hey, wait a second, you know, dynamite isn't red. Dynamite is actually beige. Those are highway flares that Cooper has in his briefcase. And even though they suspected that the bomb wasn't real, they didn't want to risk trying to overtake him at the time or having the pilots try any funny stuff, as the hijacker warned against.
Now, there's very little physical evidence that we have available. I mean, when you mention, actually, it's an interesting thing to talk about. When you mentioned that she saw red, she could have been mistaken, or maybe she wasn't mistaken, and they were highway flares. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, in a situation like this, you always have to, you know, you're talking to witnesses, and sometimes witnesses see completely different things when they all watch the same event. And, you know, when you look at the evidence of certain people, you know, there was a specific description given of D.B. Cooper by the witnesses. And later people that maybe claimed to be D.B. Cooper or were suspected to be D.B. Cooper, you know, it was like, oh, they're too tall, they're too short, this, that. You know, how much, I mean, in your personal opinion, do you believe that differences, you know, if you've got a lot of evidence, but maybe it all falls apart because of a person's height, how important is that to you in terms of deciding whether or not that's a good reason to throw out the suspect?
Well, right now in this country, we're actually in the middle of an innocence epidemic, and we have, as DNA testing becomes more popular and more accessible and more used, we're finding out that literally hundreds of people are in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And the number one cause for wrongful convictions and the reason why so many innocent people are in prison is because of faulty identifications. We are always, often, wrong about what we see. And the fact that we believe or are so convinced in it has created a lot of problems in our court system. And the same is true in this case. Here we have a dark plane in the middle of a hijacking and a handful of witnesses who, for the most part, saw sort of the same guy, but also offered details that were conflicting.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was reporting the story, and when I was considering all these different suspects, you know, I actually was pretty lenient, or more lenient than I think a lot of other Cooper sleuths or FBI agents have been in terms of the physical description. Moreover, I also discovered some new, never before been made documents that detailed new witnesses' observations of the hijacker that were very detailed, that were very vivid, if not the most detailed ever, that have never before been made public and were never taken into account in the sketches that the FBI made, and they haven't been presented forward. So the hijacker to me was a chimera. He had different components described by different people, but conflicting. He could have been anywhere between 5'8" and 6'1". It's a long way to go in terms of height.
It's a big jump.
He could, you know, the color of his eyes to me are still up for grabs because he wore sunglasses most of the time, and the only stewardess alleged to have seen him claimed that they were brown. But, you know, it's hard to say. You know, it's really hard to say, and it's really hard to pin the identity of someone in such a heavy, high-stakes case on a physical ID under those circumstances, definitely.
Now, aside from walking up to the ticket counter, for the vast majority of actual time that he was on the plane, he was sitting down as well, right?
Correct. So, you know, it's really unclear how anybody, especially even, you know, the guy sitting next to him who, you know, who said he was 5'9", how did he really know he was 5'9"? You know, it's unclear. I mean, there was a moment where he was standing, and this is after the passengers were released, and he was alone with Tina Muckelow, the youngest stew on the crew and who spent the most time with him. And she said that he was taller than her, and she was 5'8". And so from that, we can conclude that at the very least, the hijacker was taller than 5'8". How much taller? It's unclear.
Now, the story that has been told is that he jumped, you know, never seen again. Some money was later recovered. But a theory I'd never heard before, and actually one of our listeners wanted me to ask you about this, was the idea that, in fact, he never even jumped. he hid somewhere on the plane, and you know, and later after they, you know, they didn't see him, and he just walked away. But I mean, I get the impression reading the book that the plane was quite thoroughly searched upon landing. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what comes up, and you know, what's come up actually a lot is that this idea that maybe Cooper didn't jump, and by releasing the stairs, it was just a decoy.
Sure.
And when the plane landed in Reno, he rolled out to the end. But why that didn't happen, or why that's unlikely to have happened, is because when the plane landed in Reno to refuel, it was trailed by two FBI cars, two unmarked FBI vehicles. And they trailed the plane to ensure that nobody rolled out. Furthermore, when they searched the plane in Reno, they did check behind the panels, and were keenly aware that the hijacker could have been hiding within the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So while it's tempting and a romantic vision, and I think that Cooper had the kind of mind to potentially think of something like that, I don't think it happened.
Now, when the plane landed in Reno, and I could be wrong about this, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression was that they later went back and I mean, they were looking through, okay, now what happened with the elevation? There was this bump here at this certain point, and we presume that that's when he jumped. I mean, my impression was that they didn't, I mean, they landed, and then it's like, oh, he's gone, so he must have jumped. Let's go back and find out when that would have been. So I'd presume upon landing, I mean, the first thing you do is go back, where's the guy? He's not there. Or was it a deal where as they were heading into Reno, they presumed he was no longer on the plane?
Wait, say again?
Just take us through the storyline of heading in to land in Reno. I mean, when they were heading in for a landing, did they still presume he was on the plane, or at that point did they believe he was already gone?
At that point, while the plane was sort of over the southern part of Washington State, inside the cockpit, lights began to flash on, and one of the lights was the aft stairs light from the rear of the plane. And the flight engineer and the pilots noticed this, and they could tell that after the light went on, the cabin pressure of the airplane changed, and the cabin pressure gauge began to spiral out of control. And at that point, they said, they radioed back to headquarters, he's doing something with the aft stairs. He must be doing something with the aft stairs. And Minneapolis, which is then Northwest, we radioed back and said, look, at some point or other, somebody's going to have to go back there and see if he's still there. It was the general consensus of the flight crew at the time that he had jumped. They called out to him numerous times, hey, sir, can we do anything for you? Are you back there? Or is everything okay? And nothing came back. So they, as they were making their descent into Reno, it was the sort of the general opinion that that he was gone, that he had jumped. But it was really unclear also because they didn't really know how mentally stable he was or what kind of guy he was, or, you know, maybe he was hiding. Maybe he was in the bathroom.
Sure.
There's a million different possibilities.
But the point was, I mean, when they landed, I mean, obviously the first thing they did was, let's go back and check. You know, it wasn't like they'd gone back to check while they were still in flight.
Correct.
Okay. So I think that, I mean, if you know, they presumed later, once they went back there, that he's gone. I mean, that would presume that they did a quite thorough search when they went back to the plane after landing in Reno.
Definitely, and I believe that they actually got underneath the seats to look to make sure he wasn't hiding under the seats as well.
Now, the money that was later found, tell everybody that story very quickly, and the kid that found it, and has there ever been, I mean, the attaché case itself, any other evidence, has any turned up?
Well, the first piece of evidence, I mean, this case went cold, and it was, I mean, this, let's not forget, I mean, not only is the Cooper case famous for being the only unsolved hijacking, and the wonderment of this unknown man who did something so bold, potentially, you know, lethal, and just incredible, but this is also a story of the biggest manhunt, you know, in the FBI's history, or one of the biggest manhunts. I mean, I believe it's got to be the most expensive. I mean, it's been going on for 40 years, and there's been over 1,000 suspects and persons of interest to date in this case, and I can't think of another case that has that kind of spread. But this case went cold for many years. I think the first piece of evidence that was actually found was in 1976, where a hunter who was in a a town along the flight path found a placard that appeared to have come from a plane, and when he checked it out with the authorities, it was actually a placard from the same Northwest 305 jet that was located near the aft stairs of the plane, and it had come off during flight. Did the hijacker pry it off? Who knows? Or was the wind, the swirling wind, so fierce on that night that it just ripped the placard off the plane? That was found actually in the flight path, and which has led many people to speculate that the plane itself was flying in the flight path that night. 4 years later, in February of 1980, another and a major discovery was found. And this discovery came in the form of $5,800, all $20 bills that were discovered by an 8-year-old boy. And he was with his family at a place called Tina Bar, which is a sandy riverbank between the states of Washington and Oregon. And there he bent down on his knees to clear a path of sand for his father, and they were going to make a fire and cook up some hot dogs. And as he swept his elbow over the sand to sort of smoothen out a space to lay some kindling, he discovered these packets of bills that looked almost like pirate's booty because they were so charred or so aged. When they brought them home later, actually his mother thought that they would make a cool coffee table art to make a coffee table out of, she didn't like the fact that the bills themselves were so dark, so she tried to bleach them with laundry detergent.
Mm.
Later that night, a friend came over and said, "Hey, wait, these are all $20 bills. This is D.B. Cooper's money." And the family, they weren't originally from the Pacific Northwest and weren't familiar with the case, but they later called the FBI, went in, showed them the bills, the serial numbers were checked, and matched. And this money is really the only true, legitimate, hard, cold clue or lead in the case. The problem with it is that it's yet its own mystery, because the location where the money was found is in a totally different place as to where the plane flew. And there's no way the money itself could have floated, you know, 4 or 5 miles in the night sky, nor could the hijacker's parachute made it that far. So in Cooperland, you know, among the sleuths who are pursuing this case, and there are many even as we speak, the mystery of the money is just one facet. I mean, it's almost more mysterious than the identity of the hijacker, because how did the money get there? You know, and this is just one area of many that people are really in pursuit of now.
Now, no, I mean, obviously they took a record of all the money that was given to him. So at this point, aside from the money that was found by this boy, they've never found any other money in circulation. Is that correct?
Correct. Although it's unclear whether or not they were looking for it. I mean, I think that there's an idea out there that the government counts every bill.
Well, sure.
And monitors its movements. And they might do that now, but in 1971, they didn't really have a way to do that. And money has a way of kind of going in and out of circulation. The bills themselves were already 10 or 11 years old. Between 8 and 10 years old at the time. So it's unclear where they went, if they were used at all.
I was interested in that in the book because, you know, I know that there's like, I think you can go online and get all the serial numbers for all of the bills. I believe that's correct. Can you go online and get all the serial numbers?
You know, I'm not sure. I feel like I've been on sites where, you know, you do plug in serial numbers, but it's unclear how far they go back.
Sure.
And you know, like now, like cats and dogs, like have these like little chips on them. You know, we can tell where they are. The GPS. I don't think that money has that, or at least money from 63.
Well, no. I mean, the reason I bring that up is just because, I mean, let's say that you could go online and match the serial numbers if you found a dollar bill from the 60s, or a $20 bill. I mean, I just think that, like, you know, if you look at all of the money in circulation over the past 40 years and the fact that he just had $200,000 in cash, I mean, to me, I mean, finding one of those with the proper serial number would be like winning the lottery. I mean, that to me is not evidence that the money is not out there. I mean, personally, it just seems like it would be you'd have to have the money, you'd have to match up. It seems like it would be almost impossible to come across one, even if they were all over the place.
Correct. Although, you know, you never know,
and I mean,
especially in this case, you know, there's always the possibility for the truly, you know, weird and bizarre, which happens all the time.
Yeah.
But
it would be, the chances are remote.
Highly.
I guess we should talk a little bit also about, I want to go back to what you were talking about, just very quickly going back to the airline security. You mentioned that the D.B. Cooper case occurred, there were cases obviously before, and there were cases after. What was the turning point in terms of this was the moment where airlines suddenly went, all right, we got to get metal detectors in every airport, we got to take this thing seriously. Was there kind of a turning point, or was it a gradual process?
Well, you know, one of the things that I found was that, and one of the things that the FBI agents at the time were really worried about was that Cooper would become a hero, which he did, and people would try to imitate him. They would try to pull off copycat crimes. And the FBI were really adamant that the news of these hijackings didn't make the papers, because the more press that was, the more press sort of glamorized or glorified hijackings, the more people would do it. And that's exactly what happened. And there were several Cooper copycats in the months after the hijacking that were never reported. And there's a gradual building of steam movement in Washington to pass legislation that would make airports or create what's now called the sterile terminal, and which would mandate the airports install metal detectors. And that's ultimately what happened the following year in 1972.
Now,
so all, you know, every time that you go in an airport and they tell you to take off your shoes, and when they start scanning your retinas, you can thank D.B. Cooper for that, because he kind of started the whole thing.
Yeah, there you go. You mentioned the case went cold. Just give everybody a little bit of a timeline about when and why it went cold, and when and why he sort of started to become... I mean, you mentioned him becoming kind of a folk hero and that sort of thing, but was there a certain period where he kind of sort of became a legend? Like, I'm sure that, you know, originally people were like, oh, man, he got away with it and that sort of thing. But was there, like, a period where it really became a real big deal that D.B. Cooper had gotten away, and now this was kind of a legendary story?
The legend started the first day after. It was immediate. And part of the reason why it was immediate was just the hijacker's name, D.B. Cooper. Just mm-hmm. the sound of it, D.B. Cooper. It sounds so regal. It sounds so daring, but it's wrong. You know, it's just not true. It's just an accident. And here's how it came to be. You know, on the night of the hijacking, a wire writer was curious about the hijacker, and he called his FBI source to see if there was a name yet. And the FBI source picked up the phone, but they had a bad connection. And so the reporter said, "Hey, you got a name on that guy on the plane?" And the FBI agent said, "Yeah, D. Cooper." But the reporter, with a static on the phone, couldn't hear him so good. So he said, "Is that D as in dog or B as in boy?" And the agent said, over the static, "Yeah, that's right. D.B. Cooper." The name went over the wires and was reported that night and in all the newspapers the next morning. And the FBI, investigating the case out of Seattle, didn't want news of the hijacker's real alias, Dan Cooper, out. They actually wanted to keep the false information out there, because they knew that there were going to be a lot of leads coming in, and they knew that all the ones coming in about D.B. Cooper they could weed out mm-hmm. as being false, but the ones about Dan Cooper they could use to be true. But the backside to that is that the D.B. Cooper name, that magical name, grew and grew and grew, and they got so many leads about the case, they couldn't really do much investigative work. They were bogged down with so many different leads, and the investigative machine that was then J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was saddlebagged by their own nifty idea.
Now, they landed in SeaTac. He got his parachutes. He got his money. They took off again, and at some point, presumably near the Washington-Oregon border, it is believed that he jumped. And it was not like, you know, beautiful night, clear sky, blue moon. I mean, it was inclement weather. And there are a lot of people that just figure he didn't make it. And I believe that your belief is that he did make it. There's a lot of evidence for that. And what do you point to as the best evidence that he did not die during the jump?
Well, you know, in recent years, there is a sort of generally widely held belief, especially amongst law enforcement, that there's no way a guy like that on a night like that could survive a jump, especially in a place like that with all those trees, with no street lights, with no roads, with Bigfoot lurking about.
Sure.
But when you look at the files, as I did, you know, one of the things that becomes very clear is that just a couple days after the jump, FBI agents interviewed parachute experts, and they actually interviewed the guy who packed the parachutes, and they asked him, hey, was the jump possible, even on a night like that, in conditions like that, in a place like that? And the expert said, yes, it was. And actually, you didn't even need to have much training. So even from the very beginning, the FBI was given expert testimony that Cooper could have survived the jump. And one of the things that I also did was I followed later on, I followed a forensic scientist who analyzed the money. And this forensic scientist, a guy by the name of Tom Kay, who's done some really unique work, especially in paleontology, analyzed under heavy-duty microscopes the quality of the money that was found. And what he was able to ascertain, and for all the details, you know, you can check it out in the book, because I spell it out there in not too heavy a science, but in the heaviest of science that I can understand, that certain things that he found suggest that the money itself wasn't actually in the river or had been buried for very long, but might have been planted. And it's compelling stuff.
Which would indicate that he survived the jump, and then later he went to a location and planted some money so that presumably people would think he died.
Yeah, or you never know. I mean, you know, it's unclear what that proves. I mean, you know, the hijacker himself maybe could have died. You know, who knows? You know, the imagination can conjure up all different kinds of possibilities. I mean, maybe he landed in the woods and died, and some hikers found the money and for some reason planted it there. Who knows? But what we were able to find, or what Tom Kay and his team was able to find, was that the money tells a different story also about what we know about the hijacker. Although what exactly happened, what truly, truly happened, what is 100% conclusive after he left that plane, nobody knows.
Now, D.B. Cooper became a folk hero, and obviously, you know, when you're talking about folk heroes, there have been a million of them. They're often romanticized, and you mentioned that there are two sides of D.B. Cooper, and there's a side that, you know, you believe a sad, lonely person, perhaps suicidal, but this is kind of a case where when you talk to the people that he dealt with, I mean, he was a very kind man. I mean, he wanted meals on the plane for the individuals flying the flight crew. And, you know, when he was handed the bag of money, and I believe the stewardess said, you know, can I have a little, kind of as a joke, and he handed her a wad of bills.
Right.
And, you know, she said he treated me very, very well. He was a gentleman. He was a nice guy. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, I'm not saying he was a great guy or anything like that, but these were reports that, like, you know, sometimes you go back and when you read about what a folk hero really did, it's like, God, this guy was a terrible human being. You know, he raped, he pillaged, blah, 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 and now he's been romanticized. But this was
but
a case
was nice
where,
about it.
Yeah, the people that dealt with him, I mean, he was a nice guy about it.
Yeah, you know, manners count.
I guess so.
You know, I think it's also important, though, when we read about his mood and mannerisms. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that hasn't been reported that I was able to find in the files, which is, you know, he got crazy there for a while, and he kept on repeating, they're not going to take me alive, they're not going to take me alive.
Sure.
You know, that wasn't reported. What we now know is that, you know, hijackings and victims of hijackings took on different kind of qualities. There is, you know, and the Stockholm Syndrome itself was born at this time. So whether or not the victims, namely the stewardesses on the crew, were under the spell of a Stockholm Syndrome or that kind of situation took on life of its own, it's conceivable that that was the case.
Now, the jump, I mean, you mentioned that you know, they interviewed people that had done jumps and had provided the parachutes, and they said that they believed that he could have survived. When you mentioned that he was possibly suicidal, I mean, do you think that the idea of making this jump on the night that he did, Because, I mean, this was a ticket bought that evening. I mean, he had to know what the weather was like, you know, in the area that this was all taking place. I mean, do you think that part of this was kind of like, man, you know, I'm going to try this, and if I make it, I got my $200,000, and if not, I die. I mean, was that kind of, do you feel sort of the mindset that he had, or do you just think he was so confident that it didn't matter the weather, he felt he was getting away?
Well, I think that from a very technical point of view, I mean, I think that the weather from Portland and in Portland and Seattle are, while they're in the same sort of, you know, region, and they're close in spirit, the weather there changes often, and it can be different in both places. And even up in the air, there are these sort of microclimates that all change. So I think that if Cooper was experienced about aviation, which I think he was, I think he knew that, you know, he had to be able to deal with whatever was thrown at him. And the weather itself did change. I mean, it went from being a light storm to a heavier storm to a lighter storm, cold and windy, not so cold, not so windy. You know, when I read the weather reports from all the different weather report stations, they're all just a little bit different, and also different at different altitudes in the air. So the weather at 10,000 feet is different than the air at sea level. So there's all different kinds of things going on, and I think that whoever the hijacker was, he had to make the calculation that, you know what, something could really go wrong here, and I could die. And, you know, what was in his head at the time, I don't know, you know, who knows, although I do know that when he got the money, the first thing he did was he put his hands in it, and he grabbed it, and he said, you know, looks okay. He was very taken by the fact that the money had come on board, almost like he hadn't expected to get it. It was almost like, you know, the stewardesses described him as being very boyish and childish about receiving the money itself. And so maybe he didn't think that he could get very far at all.
Now, based on that, have there been theories about why, for example, he asked for $200,000 and not, say, $1 million? I mean, it is. I mean, based on your. I mean, the story there, it would seem like he didn't know. You know, maybe he just figured I can get $200,000, but they ain't giving me $1 million. And he was excited that he actually got that. I mean, have there been theories about why he chose $200,000?
Yeah, you know, there's all kinds of theories about the $200,000. I mean, one of them is that $200,000 wouldn't take long to you know, for the feds to come up with $200,000 ransom.
Sure,
it wouldn't take very long. So if they needed to come up with $1 million, that could take a long time. But $200,000 was, you know, a reasonable sum.
That was it was about a million today.
It
was a very short flight, so he had limited time here.
Right, he had, you know, he wanted it by 5 p.m., so that means that basically they had 2 hours to get it. And he also had to jump with it also. So, he, you know, if there was like a big load, like $500,000 or even $1 million in cash, maybe it was too heavy. I mean, the $200,000 load came to 20 pounds, which is a lot of weight to jump with. Especially, you know, it didn't come in a backpack. You know, he asked for a knapsack, but it actually came in a loose-mouthed canvas bag, which he cannibalized a parachute shroud and tied it up like a present, and was, I believe, planning to jump with it around his waist, and probably, if he knew about jumping with objects, probably put it or gripped it tight with his legs or with his knees and jump with it between his knees. So $200,000, when you look back at it, is actually probably the most he could probably have gotten away with and actually come away with or been able to jump successfully. You know, another theory I heard, which is sort of comes from the conspiracy theory corner, which is a big one in this case, and some reasons to engage with it and some not, but that if Cooper was, you know, a rogue operative and was operating sort of as a quote-unquote asset, working to, on behalf of friendly U.S. powers, to create a climate where airport security would be strengthened, he would have already been paid before the jump, and the money itself was just a sort of souvenir.
Sure. Now, let's talk a little bit about you and your personal involvement in the case. Tell everybody a little bit about, first, how you became interested, and I guess, second, how you became obsessed.
Well, as an investigative reporter, you kind of need to be obsessive to carry on in a lot of these stories. And I'm a crime writer. I write a lot about unsolved crimes and mysteries and detection. And I knew nothing about the D.B. Cooper case. I'd never heard of it. It happened before I was born. But I happened to be talking to one of my sources one day. He was a private investigator by the name of Skip Porteous, who runs a company called Sherlock Investigations. And we'd always sort of talked about doing a story together about one of his cases. And they all sort of didn't really work out for one reason or another. And he called me one day and he said, "Hey, you want to have lunch? I got something for you." And I was just so hungry at the time, I couldn't even begin to digest what he was telling me. So we met, and he proceeded to tell me about this guy who contacted him and with a real yarn. And the guy was an elderly gentleman living in the middle of nowhere, Minnesota. He was an inventor, a kooky, retired postal office worker. And after doing his own investigation, he became absolutely convinced that he knew who the hijacker was. And who he thought the hijacker was his older brother, Kenny Christensen, from Bonnie Lake. And from there, I got really interested in the case. I mean, it's impossible not to be interested in it. It is a case that seduces you. It sucks you in. And not only was I interested in who the hijacker was, but I was also interested in what prompted so many people to believe that their loved ones, their boyfriends, their neighbors, their older brothers, were Cooper. It's a real phenomenon. There's a reason why there's over 1,000 suspects and persons of interest in the case, and the reason is because people keep on turning each other in. And so I began to explore that phenomenon as well, and that led me to other suspects, other Kenny Christensens. And to me, some of the real riches in the story are just the secret lives of such ordinary, normal people. And I couldn't help. It was impossible not to get obsessed with it because, one, I had to know who the hijacker was, and two, I had to know why so many people were in pursuit of him.
What do you feel was some of the best evidence for and against Kenny Christensen? Because in your book, I mean, this book is not about just one suspect. I mean, there's a number of different individuals, including one individual who got a sex change and ended up using the name Cooper. And for Christensen, for example, what is some of the best and worst evidence, or best the strongest evidence and evidence that suggests that maybe it wasn't him?
Well, the best evidence to suggest it is him, in my take, and this is just my take, is that Kenny lived a secret life. He lived. He had hid his sexuality from his family. And what I mean to say by that is just he was gay, and that doesn't mean that you're a hijacker because you're gay. Actually, a lot of hijackers themselves, studies showed, possessed heavy feminine tendencies when you look at the studies of hijackers. But in my take, why Kenny Christensen is such a good suspect is because he was in the paratroopers, and he actually paratrooped for extra money as a hobby. In reading his letters home, something about volunteering to jump with such primitive parachute equipment for a couple bucks. To me, you have to be a certain kind of person to volunteer for that assignment. And so I thought that if he had reached his wit's end in the fall of 1971, then why not resort to something that you'd known to do for extra money? Another thing is actually a curious photograph found that was taken shortly after Thanksgiving and it was believed to have been taken by a self-timer. And Kenny apparently took a photo of himself, and he was wearing a dark raincoat, a leather attaché case, and in one hand he was clutching a canvas sack, which is exactly what the hijacker brought on board. And Kenny's brother, Lyle, thought that this photograph was actually Kenny's way of preserving evidence of himself being the hijacker. It's a pretty spooky photo.
And Kenny died of cancer many years ago, actually.
Correct. He died in 1994 of pancreatic cancer. And, you know, one of the things that his brother remembers from his last days was that Kenny pulled him close and he said, you know, there's something I need to tell you. And his brother said, look, no, it doesn't matter. Don't tell us. Whatever it is, we still love you. And now what irks younger brother Lyle is that what did Kenny want to confess to on his deathbed? You know, what was his confession? Was he going to confess to being the hijacker? Now the evidence against Kenny is namely that he is a little short. You know, on one form of ID, Kenny is listed as 5'8", and on another, he's 5'9". And if you remember, you know, Stuart Smucklow said that the hijacker was higher, taller than 5'8". So if she reported that he was a lot taller than 5'8", she didn't report a lot taller, but if he was taller than 5'8", it suggests that the hijacker himself could have been a little bit taller than Kenny.
That was the height thing that I was talking about earlier. Just, you know, with Kenny Christensen, I mean, there was more than just the height. I mean, he was bald, is that correct? And so there was like this belief that he'd worn a toupee?
Well, that might have come out later. I mean, at the time, at least according to the first sketch, I mean, the hijacker himself was really thin on hair, especially at the top.
Sure.
And Kenny, in photos from around that period, was definitely thin on the top, but he wasn't totally bald. Other eyewitness statements that hadn't been made public suggest that the hijacker actually had a full head of hair and had wavy hair.
Hmm.
So was that Kenny's toupee, or was that just another guy with wavy hair?
Sure.
Remains to be seen. A lot of other suspects, including this most recent one that's come forward, had wavy hair.
Yeah, when I look at, like, if there's a lot of evidence and it just comes down to the physical thing, I mean, like you were talking about earlier, I mean, you know, things happen and many different people see many different things, even if they're all looking at the same thing. And if you're 5'8", and there's someone in front of you that's also 5'8", I mean, if you're looking directly at them and you're eye to eye, you know, you're looking up to see the top of their head. And, you know, a guy could show up and he could have, you know, wear shoes that have a higher heel. You know, there's a lot of different things. And, I mean, it's just, I just kind of feel like the physical saying, oh, you know, he was too short or this and that. I mean, it's just so hard in these cases to rule somebody out based on something like, you know, different people saying that he was a different height.
I agree. And, you know, when... I totally agree. It's one of the reasons why I continue to investigate Kenny Christensen for a very lengthy period of time.
Give me a quick look at some of the other suspects that you touch on in the book. I mean, just kind of touch on them briefly here. And obviously, if people want the full story, it's in the book.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that I set about doing was just to investigate everything I could. And in addition to investigating the case and to figure out what exactly happened and what the difference was between the myth and the actual facts, I started looking at a lot of suspects, and I finally whittled them down to four characters that I chose to explore in a narrative form in the book. There are others I refer to sort of glancingly, but they are Kenneth Christensen, which we've mentioned. Bob Barbara Dayton, who was a, you know, former merchant marine sailor and all-around handyman, who was a super tough alpha male macho dude and a dangerous guy, and the reason why is because he always felt like he was a woman inside and was the first transgender patient in the state of Washington. Another was Richard Floyd McCoy Jr., who was a former Green Beret and kind of went rogue. Definitely went rogue, later escaped out of prison with a gun made of plaster of Paris, dental plaster of Paris, and was shot dead by FBI agents in a shootout in 1974. And the other was Dwayne Lauren Weber, who was an insurance salesman and a leading one at that, won a lot of free dinners and cruises with his company, and also lived a double life under the name John C. Collins and spent time in five federal penitentiaries and was a career con artist. His wife later learned after his death, going through his things and finding out all his false identification in a secret compartment in his van. And all these suspects have their own sort of claims to the case. All of them are compelling. And at one point, I thought all of them were D.B. Cooper. And I sat back and I was like, you know, wait, this can't be. And what's going on here? Why do I believe? Why am I not believing in my own sense of logic? And to me, that's also what this story is about. It's about the truth. And what is the truth? Is it what we want to believe or what's actually there? And, you know, is the truth... Yeah, when is it that we'll change our minds? You know, when is that point? You know, there's this idea that the first thought always gets in free. That's what Tom Kay always told me. And I think that people in the case are so convinced that their own suspects are the hijacker that they won't rest until that's proven true and they can redeem themselves, you know, because a lot of people feel like, you know, after investigating it for 10, 15 years, they need to prove their case because... if they don't, then people will think they're crazy. And the problem is that for a lot of people, they've been investigating it so long and they've been trying to prove it for so long that people have just sort of brushed them aside, you know, and a lot of people are crying wolf out there.
It's very interesting because your book was published in early August, I believe. And, like, literally that week, I believe, big story all over the country. D.B. Cooper mystery believed solved.
And, well, it took us a while to plan all that.
That's just interesting. There, some woman came forward, Lynn Doyle Cooper, last name Cooper, and said, you know, my uncle was the guy. And I guess, you know, they had some, I guess a necktie was left behind by the actual D.B. Cooper. And so they ended up doing all the DNA testing, that sort of thing. And apparently it appears that there was no match, but... I guess investigators have not completely ruled it out, but obviously I presume you've been following the story. And what are your thoughts on this new lead?
Well, you know, what I think about the new lead is that it's like many other once new leads in the Cooper file. You know, here is a person who has a memory from the time she was 8 years old that had been rediscovered from a father who she later claimed was a conspiracy theorist about a guy she really didn't know all that well. And, while there's a lot to like, I think, about her suspect in the photo that's come out about him, we really know nothing about who Uncle L.D. Lynn Doyle Cooper is or was. Didn't know really what he did, didn't know what skills he had, didn't know what motives he had, what he was like, where he was in 1971, where he was in 1970. Nothing, nada, no data, no evidence. So as a suspect, it's hard to think more. It's hard to think anything about him because we know nothing about this man. But what's interesting is why the story continues to resonate in a major way. And I think one of the reasons why is because we find ourselves in 40 years after the case, approaching the 40th anniversary of the Cooper thing, in a very similar time as to when it actually happened. I mean, Mark Twain had this famous line, and he said, you know, history never repeats itself, it only rhymes. And I think now, 40 years later, there's a real rhyming effect going on as to where we are in our culture. A lot of the same conditions prevalent as they were in 1971 when this legend was hatched. A bad economy that sucks. A feeling of helplessness. Truly a feeling that we've lost our sense of individuality as we become more mechanized, as we, you know, everything becomes more computer operated. We feel that we have lost our power as individuals. And what Cooper represents above all is the power of it. What one individual can do, even with one jump. And I think that's what's so unique, or that's what's so, I think, important about this latest Cooper mania that's actually resonated for the first time more than anything since the hijacking itself.
I was born in 1975, so it was 4 years after this happened, but it was fascinating. Again, I was talking about history at the very beginning, but it's funny you mention that because, I mean, you do talk about that in the book. I mean, you're just talking about the what life was like in 1971 over Thanksgiving weekend, which is coming up here very soon, like you said, the anniversary. And, I mean, you just read it, and it was just like you talked about, you know, recession. And I mean, I read it, and it was almost like, God damn. You don't think about it, but things seem like it was a hell of a lot worse then than it is today, at least in some ways. But it was a very similar sort of time. And just, you know, it's just really interesting to read all that stuff. So, you know, it is 40 years coming up, and I guess the question to you is, what could we look for someday as far as definitive evidence? I mean, what is needed here for the FBI and for everybody to comfortably say, okay, it's over, this is what happened?
Well, here's what I think people need to know. The hunt continues. I mean, there are people that are totally devoted to this case, and one of the things that I wanted to do with this book is pepper the narrative with the actual facts of the case. So if people want to become their own Cooper sleuth or do their own hunting and actually get involved in the case and help try to break it open, they could use the book as a sort of field guide to find a different part that they want to work on. This fall, I'm actually going to be hosting a symposium for the 40th Cooper year anniversary. Every year there's a Cooper party in Ariel, Washington. That's been going on for 40 years. This is going to be the 40th. This is going to be a huge event. And a lot of leading Cooper sleuths are going to be coming to the symposium, leading talks, lecturing on various different parts of the case. And then we're all going to go to the party in Ariel, which is going to be definitely a wild time. So if you have interest in this case, you definitely want to show up for that. That's going to be November 26th in Portland, Oregon. Now, as to whether the case can actually be solved, in my opinion, it can be solved. And it can be solved actually more easily than we think. And here's how. On that flight, when the plane landed in Reno, federal agents were able to recover critical pieces of evidence. And they came in the form of 8 Raleigh filter-tip cigarette butts. And these were the cigarette butts that the hijacker smoked throughout the hijacking. At the time, agents took those butts and sent them to Quantico, Virginia, to the FBI's lab for analysis. And after they were able to identify the butts and catalog them, the butts were sent back to Las Vegas, Nevada, for keeping. In recent years, when the most recent former case agent Larry Carr out of Seattle wanted to reanalyze the physical evidence that was found, the cigarette butts were missing. They were not with the other physical evidence that had been found in the plane, and the FBI does not know or has not been able to find the location of these 8 Raleigh filter-tip cigarette butts. And why the butts are so important is because in the cotton fibers of the filter is most likely saliva from the hijacker that we know as definitively as his, and it could potentially be used to extract a full genetic code. Now, the other physical evidence that was recovered in the plane has been able to yield only partial DNA strains and from other people, namely the Thai. Mm-hmm. And the fingerprints that are on the in-flight magazine that was also recovered are also partial prints and likely from everyone else who was on that plane leafing through that magazine in the flights before. The answer is in the cigarette butts. We need to find these cigarette butts, and we need to test them to see if a genetic code could be yielded from them. And then once we get that full genetic code, we know who the hijacker is from a DNA standpoint, and then we can just run the numbers and see who pops up. But until those cigarette butts are found, this case, in my opinion, is going to go cold for a very long time.
One last question here before we wrap it up, since you mentioned physical evidence. I don't know enough about this. I hope you do, but the bag was given to him, and he leafed through the money, and the stewardess said, "Can I have a little of that?" or whatever her line was, and he handed her a bundle of it. And she said, you know, something to the effect of, you know, I can't take this, and he took it back. Should she have kept that?
The money itself?
Yeah. I mean, would there have been prints? Would there have been, I mean, would that have been valuable evidence, or is it just that the way that these bills are put together probably wouldn't have made any difference?
You know, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things that he touched that actually he wanted back. For instance, she lit his cigarette, and he had touched the matchbook lighter, the matchbook cover of his case, and he actually demanded that back and put it in his pocket. He demanded his original note back. So if she was, you know, it would be a heads-up play to grab that money and to take it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, At that time, she was thinking is how can I keep this plane from being blown up?
Sure.
Keep on living and keep these passengers safe.
Yeah.
So
no, I'm not blaming her in any way. I'm just wondering if, like, because when I first heard he handed her this and she gave it back, my first thought was, oh my God, I mean, what could have been on that stack of bills if she hadn't given it back? You know, not blaming her or anything like that, just that was the first thing that popped
right
into my mind.
Or, you know, what was in the garbage, you know, I mean, one of the things I think they did, or if they didn't do it, they should have, is to go through the garbage and try to find that bourbon and seven that he, the glass for that bourbon and seven that he drank.
Sure, yeah.
To try to get some prints off that glass.
Yeah. God, now I'm going to be obsessed with this for the next 40 years, so.
Sorry. No, seriously, it's like once you get started, there's no other way but to go down the sinkhole. So good luck.
Yeah.
Call me.
Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper is the name of the book. It was just published out in hardcover in bookstores everywhere right now. You can also get it on your Kindle. If you don't have a Kindle, if you've got an iPad, they've got a Kindle app. There's a Kindle app you can download for your computer. There's really no excuse to not get this book, and it's a fascinating book. And I mean, just the stuff we touched on today is just scratching the surface of everything you can read in the book. So please check it out. Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper, up at Amazon.com and your local bookseller. And Jeffrey Gray, I want to thank you very much for doing the show today. I very much appreciate it. And best of luck. I hope that at some point in your lifetime, this mystery is solved, and hopefully you're the one to solve it.
Let's hope so. And thank you for having me. See you at the 40th anniversary symposium and party in Portland, Oregon. And also you can check out HuntForDBCooper.com, which is where I'm posting a lot of sort of updates and Cooper news. So look forward to all that.
Cool, and I may see you there. And of course, thank you everybody for listening. We shall talk to you again after a while.